You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable TV systems all around the country. It's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. As I've so many times said, I think of him as America's senator. I know Vermonters are very pleased to claim him as their own. Vermont that just this week voted to stop fracking. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The French elections, the Europeans are saying no to what our Republican Party is trying to shove down our throats here.
Right. Well, I think what happened in France, and to a certain degree what happened in Greece and in Germany on Sunday, is going to be a shot heard not only all over Europe, but all over the United States of America. And that I think that people perceive now that all over the world, with the middle class and working class in decline, with unemployment sky high, people are simply saying, sorry, we don't want austerity to be hitting working families who are struggling right now to pay their bills, to send their kids to college. We would like a little bit of austerity for the people who are doing phenomenally well, the top 1%. And I think that was the message in France, and I think you're hearing that message more and more in the United States of America. And clearly, to a significant degree, that's what this election cycle will be about. I strongly disagree, needless to say, with our Republican colleagues who think that at a time when the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well, the last report we have in the year 2010 is that 93% of all new income created in that year compared to 2009 went to the top 1%. You got that, Tom?
That's
amazing. It's just an unbelievable statistic. Almost everything, all of the new income went to the very richest people in this country. Yeah. Middle class, working families got virtually nothing. And I think that trend has continued since then. So what people are saying, when you have the 400 wealthiest people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of our country, and that gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is getting wider, no. For the working families of this country, we don't need cuts in Social Security. We don't need cuts in Medicare and in Medicaid and in education and environmental protection. And we sure as hell don't need more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. So I think that was the message sent by the voters in France, Greece, and in Germany. And I think that is the message that you're going to increasingly hear around the United States of America, that it's time for the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. It's time to end these incredible loopholes that corporations that make billions of dollars enjoy. It's time to have these guys start paying their fair share of taxes. And in line with that, I should tell you that Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota and I this week introduced legislation that would end all of the tax breaks and subsidies and government funding that the fossil fuel industry, the oil and coal companies, receive, which amounts to about $113 billion over a 10-year period.
Wow.
I don't have to go to great lengths to explain the insanity, the absurdity of giving tax breaks to a company like ExxonMobil, which it has made more profits in a given year than any corporation in the history of humanity. And at the same time, in recent years, we've had an instance where ExxonMobil, after making billions in profits, paid zero in taxes, actually got a rebate from the IRS. So our oil company friends who are ripping us off day after day, charging us outrageous prices for gas, certainly do not need tax breaks from the United States Congress. And the Congressman Ellison and I introduced legislation to end that. Also, interestingly, today, it was revealed that our good friends at J.P. Morgan Chase are going to lose a couple of $1 billion on a gambling venture that they undertook, which went wrong. Which leads us to another issue that we have worked hard on and we're going to work even harder on, and that is the absolute need, if this economy is going to survive for the middle class, to break up the largest six financial institutions in this country, which, if people can believe it, have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America.
Wow.
I mean, it's an extraordinary fact. So that speaks to, that's over $9 trillion controlled by six banks, J.P. Morgan Chase being one, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citi being the four largest, and then you got Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley being the fifth and sixth. And what I worry about with that kind of concentration of ownership is you're not seeing the kinds of investment we need from Wall Street into the productive economy to create real jobs. So you got companies all over America ready to expand, ready to put people to work, ready to produce goods and services. They can't get money they need from Wall Street at a reasonable rate. On the other hand, Wall Street continues, as J.P. Morgan Chase just was found out to do, engaging in gambling and placing, you know, huge bets. And that's not what our economy should be based on. So we continue to need fundamental reform from Wall Street. It is not going to be easy. These guys are unbelievably powerful. They have unlimited sums of money to put into politics and into media and so forth. So it's going to be a tough fight, but I think what we learned about J.P. Morgan Chase just convinces me that we have got to continue to go forward and break up these large financial institutions. I would say also this week, and it's been a busy week, I applaud President Obama for coming out for gay marriage. We in Vermont were the first state in the union to pass civil unions and the first state to pass a gay marriage law without a court order. And I think what you're seeing now is what used to be a big, big deal is no longer a big deal. And especially among younger people, but I think more and more people who see gay marriage, they don't see it threatening their own lives, their own marriages. And I think people understand that in a free society, people have the right to love whomever they want to love. So I applaud the president for moving forward in that direction. There is an issue that we got hung up with in the Senate virtually all week, and that is the student loan issue, the Stafford loan. Very serious issue. If Congress does not act, Stafford loans will go up from 3.4% to 6.8%. I have talked to many young people in Vermont, and I know it's certainly true all over this country, who are struggling with huge student debt, get out of school. On average, it's about 25,000. Some have 30, 40, 50,000. Go to graduate school, could be 100 plus thousand. Have to pay off these loans. The economy for young people and college graduates right now is very, very weak. So you're getting kids coming out of school deeply in debt, not finding decent paying jobs, stuck with these loans. What we certainly don't want to do is to raise those interest rates from 3.4 to 6.8%. So that's an issue we're working on. I think the Democrats have a reasonable proposal to do away with a loophole that benefits wealthy taxpayers, and I think that's the right way to go. The Republicans, of course, want to cut back on health care, so that's an issue. As we have discussed on this program for a number of months now, Tom, we have been working hard on postal reform, the need for comprehensive postal reform. The Senate passed a reasonably good bill which would protect rural post offices, protect mail delivery standards so people get their mail in a reasonable time, protect jobs within the Postal Service and processing plants. The Postmaster General this week made an announcement which was, in a sense, good news and bad news. He has come to the view that, unlike his previous position, we should not be shutting down 3,700 rural post offices, but what he wants to do is reduce hours in them. We can perhaps talk about that later.
Okay, we'll pick that up on the other side of the break. And your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. You can sign his amendment to the Constitution to reverse Citizens United.
And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. It's the It's the Tom Hartman Program. Our brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, right at the calls?
I'm ready.
Okay. Doug in Port Royal, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I got a question. Yesterday I heard Senator Blunt from Missouri say that the student loan program that's supposed to go from 3.4 to 6.8 was put in there by the Obama administration to pay for the health care plan. And I want to know if that's true.
No, I don't believe that is true.
No.
No, I think that's just not correct at all. In any case, the debate is that was done what happened is there was money put in to subsidize the Stafford loan program, and that's about to expire. I think that that was done 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that what's happening is that the right-wingers are reverse spinning things because the Republicans are proposing to pay for extending the student loan lower rates by cutting social programs, including Obamacare. So they're saying because the Democrats won't go along with cutting Obamacare, they're choosing Obamacare over student loans, which
is a little bit convoluted.
It is. It's
quite follow that. But
phony logic.
What the Republicans do want to do, I think it's about a $6 billion for 1 year to extend the 3.4% student rates, and the Republicans want to take that money out of disease prevention. So we're working now frantically, trying to address the growing problem of diabetes, trying to get kids off tobacco, off alcohol, off drugs, which saves lives and saves money in the long term, and that's what the Republicans want to cut and pay, subsidize the student loan with. That does not make sense to me.
Mary Lou, watching us on Free Speech TV in New Orleans, Louisiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. Do you think that the bets that Chase was caught making with credit default swaps, do you think that's hedge fund people getting what they deserve? Or do you think patriotic Americans should step in now and take some steps to bust up those trusts, to use the Sherman Act to antitrust the banks and make them smaller and protect American taxpayers from another recession?
Mary Lou, that is exactly what I think. As I said earlier, you know, the media moves on and sometimes forgets about the most important issues. The most important issue from an economic point of view in this country, in my view, that we have got to continue to focus on is the greed, the recklessness, and the illegal behavior which takes place on Wall Street and that mentality which drove us into this terrible recession, which has caused so many Americans to lose their jobs, their homes, and their life savings. And despite Dodd-Frank, which was a modest step forward, we have got a long way to go. And I think Mary Lou from Louisiana is exactly right. And that is, these guys have so much power over the economic life of this nation that you cannot allow to continue six huge financial institutions, six, which have a combined assets of over $9 trillion, which is the equivalent of two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America. That's too much power in too few hands. And it has a negative impact on the economy, and it leads us, as Mary Lou just said, to the possibility of another too big to fail, where they're going to come running to the taxpayers to be bailed out again. And I think what Mary Lou said is right. I think what we need to do is have a banking system run by smaller banks who understand that their role in life is to invest in the productive economy, not in gambling casinos, which is what these large banks now do, but to help businesses get the loans they need so they can make investments, so they can create jobs in the United States of America.
Mary Ann in New York City, listening on WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Did you say Mary Ann?
I did. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I wanted to know, I hear this argument from Republicans that we have to give corporations everything they want or they're going to take their toys and go someplace else. And that doesn't make sense to me. It seems that we're giving them an enormous amount of power and we should be the ones wielding the power, you know, making the laws and saying if you don't abide by them, then, you know, fine, go wherever you want. And how valuable are you know, is a corporation that doesn't pay taxes and outsources its jobs anyway?
Well, Marianne, I think you are quite right. So we've gotten very good comments, Tom, from Mary Lou and Marianne.
Indeed.
Mary's are doing very well.
Yeah.
Here's what's going on. In recent years, What we have seen large corporations do is really turn their backs on the American people. It is the American consumer and the American worker who have made these corporations wealthy and powerful and great. And they have said, thank you, but no thank you. We're gone. We're going to move to China. We're going to hide our money in tax havens around the world because we don't want to pay taxes to the United States government. We're going to use our money to elect right-wing politicians. And that's the thanks that the American consumer and worker have gotten. Furthermore, I would say that the vast majority of the new jobs being created in America do not come from the large corporations. Quite the contrary. They have downsized very substantially in recent years. The new jobs that are being created are often from startup companies and smaller companies, smaller businesses. I think our strategy toward corporate America is to say, sorry, you are going to pay your fair share of taxes in the United States. If your large oil companies are making billions in profits, you're not going to get away with paying in some years nothing at all in federal income tax. If you're one of the top, if you're one of one quarter of the corporations in America, you are going to have to pay something in taxes. And I think we need to change our trade policies, Marianne, to say that if they want to sell products in the United States, they should start investing in the United States and create jobs here as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, and you can sign his amendment to the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Which would, Bernie's amendment to the Constitution, would roll back Citizens United. In fact, Pat Leahy's going to have hearings on this in the Senate next week, I understand. We'll be back with more Senator Sanders.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Bernie, you're still here? Hello, Bernie? Yeah. Okay. Bernie, you're still here, right?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Let's pick it up here. Evelyn in Isla Miralda, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Seems like if corporations consider themselves people, why don't they have an alternative minimum tax like people do? Seems to me they want all the privileges without any of the responsibility.
That's an excellent idea, Evelyn. But I have to tell you that at the end of the day, I don't consider corporations as people. And I think we need to make sure the corporations start paying their fair share of taxes because they're corporations, not because they're people. And as Tom mentioned, we're working hard on a constitutional amendment to undo this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allows corporations to spend as much money as they want on political campaigns. And I'm happy to say that my colleague from Vermont, Senator Pat Leahy, who's chairman of the Judiciary Committee, will be holding hearings on a constitutional amendment. I think that's a good step forward.
It's a great step forward. Laurel in Adrian, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders and Tom, both of you. I appreciate the great work you do for all of us here in America. I'm a first-time caller, so excuse me if I'm kind of nervous, but not so much a question but a statement. Just to those who say that government spending doesn't create jobs, doesn't create anything special for our economy, I just want to give you a personal story of mine. You know, I like to tell people that President Eisenhower was my favorite president, and I get a lot of funny looks when I say that because President Eisenhower was before I was born. But then I tell them, well, Eisenhower was the one who implemented the interstate highway system. And my dad was on the road construction crew building the interstate highway system through town when he met my mom. So to those who say that government programs do not create anything, I'm living testament to the fact that government programs do create things. I'm alive today because of what Eisenhower did. I'm alive today because of the work my dad did.
Yep, Laurel. Let's get Bernie's thoughts on that, Laurel. Thank you.
The interstate highway system. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah,
but we created Laurel, and but Laurel's point is a very interesting and important point. And just think about it. Back when Eisenhower, who was president from 52 to 60, was president, he was a moderate Republican. That's all he was. And he thought it important for a number of reasons, not the least of which were defense related, but he thought it important that we have an interstate highway system from the East Coast to the West Coast. And that's what we built. And it's been enormously important for this country ever since. That was a moderate Republican. Now, today, after years of transportation bills, we can't even get the Republicans in the House of Representatives to agree on a modest, bipartisan Senate transportation bill that would put something like $109 billion into roads, bridges, and mass transit and put many, many thousands of people to work. We can't get them to agree with that. The other point that I think I would make, picking up on what Laurel said, an investment. You know, Tom, we forget about this. When we think about Abraham Lincoln, we think always about the Civil War. But we forget that it was Lincoln during his administration in the early 1860s.
It's July 2nd, 1862.
Who did what?
When he signed the, well, maybe we're thinking of different things. That was when he signed the Land-Grant College Act, the Morrill Act.
That's exactly right. So here you have, in the midst of a Civil War, which was, it was at that point not sure whether this country would survive, you have Lincoln signing legislation which says it's important that we have land-grant universities. And also during the Lincoln administration, there were significant investments made into the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he funded that, too.
So here you have intellectual infrastructure in terms of universities and infrastructure in terms of rail going from coast to coast because President Lincoln and the people in that time understood how important those investments were for this country. So you had a huge deficit as a result of the Civil War. Questions whether the nation would survive, and they said, wait, we have to invest in the future of America. And right now, we can't get people in our Republican colleagues in the House and many in the Senate to start investing to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. So we address global warming. We can't get them to invest in education. We can't get them to invest in transportation. And it speaks to a very sad state of affairs in contemporary politics.
It certainly does. Jacob in Guyton, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Oh, hello. Senator Sanders, I'd really like to thank you and basically all of the concerned citizens in Vermont for your help in trying to ban fracking. My brother lives in New Mexico, which is, you know, already a poor and ravaged state. And basically, he's watched his neighbors have their land scammed from underneath them, and watch the water supply get tainted by all the chemical work that fracking has been doing in the land. He's been, you know, fighting very aggressively with others in the community to help stop it. And when I told him what happened in Vermont, he was really overjoyed because he's seen other people. Because other people can do this in other states, so there's certainly hope for
good.
What he's fighting for.
Good. Well, Jacob, thank you very much. I would be remiss if I took any credit for that. This is something the Vermont State Legislature has done, and I support that. I personally believe that the future of energy in this country has got to be with energy efficiency. People do not appreciate the potential that we have there, not only in terms of weatherizing our homes, but getting a strong rail system to carry our cargo and our passengers, and the huge potential that we have in wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, other developing technologies. And one of the saddest things that I see in Congress every day is the inability of many of my Republican colleagues to even acknowledge the reality of global warming and the need to transform our energy system, let alone come up with good ideas. And in terms of fracking, you know, clearly in many areas, this is just an absolute environmental disaster.
Richard, in Fort Collins, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Mr. Hartman, longtime listener, first-time caller. I have a couple of ideas. One, on the Citizens United, if we could make it such that only those who are allowed to vote in elections are allowed to contribute to campaigns, that might do away with Citizens United. My other idea is if we could treat Wall Street speculation like the, you know, 6 months or less investment on Wall Street like the gambling that it is, and tax it at 50% like you do with Vegas.
Well, Richard raises some interesting questions, and that is that the issue of speculation, what is really troubling about this is that Wall Street has become, to a significant degree, an island unto itself, and many of their leaders there, many of their CEOs, are just figuring out ways that you can make a quick buck, rather than seeing their role as the financial center of America and how they can invest in improving our standard of living and helping us create jobs. So speculation is dangerous in a number of ways. A, it's just not productive, and B, when it fails, as it did a few years ago, it leads to the collapse of much of the economy and the need to bail these guys out. So there is no question in my mind that we need to deregulate, we need to re-regulate Wall Street, but most importantly, I think, we need to break up these banks, give more support to community banks, locally owned banks, banks that are concerned about their communities and investing in their communities.
Bernie, I'm assuming that there are no Republicans on board for that. What percentage of Democrats support that perspective?
Well, interestingly enough, Tom, that you have conservative, the fellow who's head of the Dallas Fed, whose name does not come to mind now, has proposed breaking up these large financial institutions.
Uh-huh.
Because from their perspective, I think, A, he worries about, once again, a too-big-to-fail situation. Because three out of the four largest banks today are bigger than they were before we bailed them out. And number two, I think if, as somebody mentioned earlier, if Teddy Roosevelt were alive today, if you had a Sherman, if you had real antitrust activity, you would not have this concentration of ownership in the financial industry.
Yeah. Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders with us on the line. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov, G-O-V. For Bernie's newsletter, you can. It's also a great news resource. It's a great progressive news site, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, of course, you can check out our website at tomhartman.com, hop into our live free chat room, and hang out with some of the finest minds in the world.
I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it, the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their master.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us and over at sanders.senate.gov. In addition to his amendment, constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United, there is a petition you can sign for their legislation to roll back the billions and billions and billions of dollars that you and I with our tax dollars are using to subsidize the oil, gas, and coal industries. Do I have that right, Bernie?
You have it exactly right.
Okay. Let's see. Sherry, in Makaleo, Hawaii, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I'm wondering if Senator Sanders knows if Congress is doing anything about the Diebold voting machines. It seems like, despite all the controversy from the last elections and the ones before, that they are still multiplying, and I don't hear anything about that in the media. Are they still owned by the right-wingers, and have they changed their name to Z, or and does he think that maybe exit polling, either government or maybe Occupy organized in at least the swing states, would help discourage the abuse that I think is going on?
Well, Sherry, that's a great question, and I know, Tom, you have been researching this and writing about this.
Yes.
You want to jump in and tell Sherry what's been going on lately?
It's still there. There's been a number of changes in ownership in some of the corporations. One of them was owned for a while out of Venezuela, which I thought was going to freak out the right wing. Didn't happen. My opinion is that the vote is the beating heart of democracy, and it should not be privatized. And
I agree with that. And I think there have been a number of states now that have passed some protective legislation against these machines. Is that correct?
I don't know.
I think there are.
Brad Friedman would be the guy who would know that.
Bottom line is, Tom is exactly right. There is nothing more important in a democracy that the people know that their vote is accurately counted, period. And I would rather wait a few minutes to get election results and know that that was true than get instantaneous results where people had some doubts about the accuracy of the machines or where it was possible for some people to do malicious things. So, Sherry, that remains a big issue. I think some states are going forward to make sure that that there are paper trails attached to machines, so when you do vote, there will be a paper record of it, and they can go back to that as well.
I'll have to check on that. Mark in Chicago, you're on the air with Bernie.
Hey, how you doing, Bernie? How you doing, Tom?
Good.
All right, I got a question. First of all, it's a pleasure to talk to both of you guys. But I have a question to ask you. I want to know how it is that the corporate world has betrayed the American people, and if you opened up a business yourselves and you were forced to pay holiday pay, sick pay, and all that other stuff, would that not be fair to you as a small business, and it's just fair to the big business because they got the money? Wouldn't it be discrimination if the smaller business are not paying the same thing? I think there should be a compromise with the corporation in order to get them back to the United States to put our people back to work. And there is a compromise that I have in mind that could work, but with your genius mind, only you guys can implement to see if it will work. And that compromise is real simple. Everyone, from bus boys all the way up to nurses and anyone who is a laborer, all get paid at a certain pay. Because in my ideal, a business is business to make money. How can they make money if they're paying all this other extra stuff? I think that they should take the money that they're making, certain part of their income that they're making, and put it toward their employees' future, or at least save up a certain percentage, like 20% of their pay, not become out of the employees' pay, but the employer's pay.
Okay. Mark, let's get Bernie's thoughts on this. This is kind of the basis.
I think you're not going to have very much Republican support, and probably not a whole lot of Democratic support for that concept. What Mark, I think, is referring to, is the fact that in America in recent years, as the middle class collapses and poverty increases, real wages for millions of workers have gone down. And we have a situation now where the top CEOs of America are now earning, last I heard, Tom, was something like 300 times more.
Yeah, it depends on whose numbers you're using and which part of the CEOs. But, yeah, somewhere between 150 and 570 times. And then if you look at Wall Street, it's over 1,000 times.
And this is kind of unprecedented in the history of America, where the people on top now kind of turning their backs on the rest of the workers and say, hey, we're going to lower your wages, take away your health care, take away your vacation time. Oh, but by the way, we are giving ourselves even more executive compensation. So is that an issue that we have to deal with? Absolutely. Do we have the strength in Congress right now to really address it? Probably not, because too many members of Congress take too many campaign contributions from big money interests.
Yeah, tragically. Bernie, we have about a minute and a half, not enough time to get another caller in here. So your wrap-up thoughts for the week?
Well, my wrap-up thoughts are that what's happening in Congress now is moving pretty fast. A lot of things are happening. People have got to pay attention. I would say that the key issue, and we've discussed a dozen important issues today, the key issue that you're going to be hearing a lot of debate about in Washington is this country has a $15.6 $1 trillion debt and a $1.2 trillion deficit. How do you go forward in dealing with that? Many of my Republican friends and some Democrats think that we should go after Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education. I don't. I think it's time to ask the wealthiest people in this country, the largest corporations, to start paying their fair share of taxes. I think there was a poll that just recently came out where the American people say we're spending too much on defense. I think you've got to take a hard look at the Defense Department as well so that we don't continue to spend more than the rest of the world combined. I think if you move in that direction, you can get deficit reduction, which is fair. I think you can have enough money to invest in our infrastructure and our energy system so we create new jobs out there that we desperately need. So I think people should pay keen attention to that debate.
Yeah, and we will be we will be here. Senator Bernie Sanders, Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And every week in all these years, it is spectacular. Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website, sanders.senate.gov, and let me remind you, there's a new petition up there that you can sign, and that is in support of Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison's legislation to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. Check it out, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Anything Goes Friday. There are. Yes, it's plural. There are multiple things going on in the world that I wanted to share with you. One of them is Joe Arpaio. This is incredible. The Department of Justice has decided that they're going to go after Sheriff Joe. And it's got the right wing's panties in a wad. They're all upset about this. Because he's their Dirty Harry character, right? He's their, I'm going to take down the bad guys. He is the friendly face of racism in America, basically, right now. And here's just, I just have to share with you some of the things that the Department of Justice has laid out in their criminal complaint against him and his department. Excuse me, legal complaint, formal legal complaint. I don't know if that's a criminal complaint or not. It certainly seems like it should be. For example, and there's a good summary of this over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, forcing women to sleep in their own menstrual blood. Ian Millhiser notes, in Arpaio's jails, female Latina LEP prisoners have been denied basic sanitary items. In some instances, female Latina, this is quoting from the Department of Justice. In some instances, female Latina LEP prisoners have been forced to remain with sheets or pants soiled from menstruation because of MCSO, that's Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, failure to ensure that detention officers provide language assistance in such circumstances. Assaulting pregnant women. Here's one example from the Justice Department filing against Sheriff Joe Arpaio. An MCSO officer stopped a Latina woman, a citizen of the United States, and 5 months pregnant at the time. Now get this. This woman is a U.S. citizen, and she's 5 months pregnant, which is generally visibly pregnant. And her crime was driving while Latino, or Latina. Anyhow, an MCSO officer stopped a Latina woman, a citizen of the United States, and 5 months pregnant at the time, as she pulled into her driveway. After she exited her car, the officer then insisted that she sit on the hood of the car. When she refused, the officer grabbed her arms, pulling them behind her back, and slammed her stomach first into the vehicle 3 times. He then dragged her to the patrol car and shoved her into the back seat. He left her in the patrol car for approximately 30 minutes without air conditioning. The MCSO officer ultimately issued a citation for failure to provide identification in her own driveway, a U.S. citizen. But it would have been horrible even if it wasn't a U.S. citizen. stalking Latino women. In another instance, during a crime suppression operation, two Maricopa County sheriff officers followed a Latino woman, a citizen of the United States, for a quarter of a mile to her home. The officers did not turn on their emergency lights, but insisted that the woman remain in her car when she attempted to exit the car and enter her own home. The officer's stated reason for approaching the woman was a non-functioning license plate light. When the woman attempted to enter her home, the officers used force to take her to the ground, kneed her in the back, and handcuffed her. The woman was then taken to a Maricopa County Sheriff's Office substation, cited for disorderly conduct, and returned home. The disorderly conduct citation was subsequently dismissed. Criminalizing living next door to the people, the wrong people, in quotes. This, again, a quote from the Department of Justice. During the raid of a house suspected of containing human smugglers and their victims, officers went to an adjacent house, which was occupied by a Latino family. The officers entered the adjacent house and searched it without a warrant and without the residents knowing consent. Although they found no evidence of criminal activity, after the search was over, the officers zip-tied the residents, a Latino man, a legal permanent resident of the United States, and his 12-year-old Latino son, a citizen of the United States, and required them to sit on the sidewalk for more than 1 hour, along with approximately 10 persons who had been seized from the target house before being released. Here's one of the most horrible of these, ignoring rape. Because of Arpaio's obsessive focus on low-level immigration offenses, his officers failed to adequately respond to reports of sexual violence, including allegations of rape and sexual assault and sexual abuse of girls. Here's another random unlawful detention of Latinos. Maricopa County Sheriff's officers stopped a car carrying four Latino men, although the car was not violating any traffic laws. Maricopa County Sheriff's officers ordered the men out of the car, zip-tied them, and made them sit at the curb for an hour before releasing them all. The only reason given for the stop was that the men's car was a little slow, which is neither a criminal nor a traffic violation. I mean, this is just incredible. And the right, because, you know, the corporate Republican Party knows that if they simply said, we're here to serve, or that they're here to serve, the 1% in terms of income and wealth in the United States and the big multinational corporations and probably Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, if they were to just come right out and say that, like Reagan did selling weapons to Iran, or like Cheney did selling oil supplies to Iran during the embargo, if they came out and said, or like Bush did, taking out Iran's biggest enemy in Saddam Hussein, if they came out and said that that's what they were all about, the top 1%, the corporate America, transnational corporations, and you know, propping up some crummy dictators overseas, if they came out and said that, nobody would vote for them. So they've got to get they got to get people to say, oh yeah, I'll vote Republican. So what do? They foment fear. Fear and hatred. Fear and hatred of brown people, black people, gay people, female people. I mean, you name it. The Republicans have a war on it, as long as it's not white. This is a party, in my mind, that is on the edge of imploding. So, anyhow, we'll see how this all this plays out. Bill in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the election in France. Holland, besides having the desire to go from austerity to growth, he also wants to reduce nuclear power. One of his goals is to do that. And if you read his socialist profile on that, one of the things he'd like to do is try to make it so people can put solar panels on top of the roofs in Paris. Which really high roofs, and I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, they do it all over Germany.
Yeah, and that's one of the things he'd like to do, and he feels that it would also increase growth, because if you reduce nuclear power, you have to supplement it with other areas, because everything runs on electricity, like the high-speed trains.
Right. Yeah, so. I'm totally with you, and I think it's a great suggestion, and thanks for pointing that out, Bill. I appreciate the call. Corey in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Corey, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? First-time caller.
Thanks.
It's Anything Goes Friday, so this might be coming out of left field. But I was wondering what you think about this idea for the housing crisis. What if we had a 20-year bond that we sold people, a housing bond, and then we would use that money to buy, like, say you're going down, you're going under, you're going to foreclose. but it's, you could afford to pay 85% of your mortgage. So what you would do is you'd sell that 15% that you can't afford to the government, and they would buy it with bonds.
That's a possibility. It seems to me that given that right now banks can borrow at 0.1% from the Fed, I mean, they're borrowing at almost nothing, that and the government, for that matter, can borrow from the Fed at that rate, and that we should be able to backstop people who have exploding mortgages, particularly mortgages, as so many of these mortgages are, that are contaminated by fraud or, you know, hustling sales practices. So I'm just horrified that that hasn't been done up to this point, and I think a lot of Americans are, and there are some, you know, there have been some very, very good attempts to fix this. Nancy Pelosi passed legislation. The Democrats passed legislation a year and a half ago out of the House of Representatives to fix this problem. The Republicans filibustered it in the Senate. So, you know, that's the problem that we have. Thank you, Corey.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com. If you'd like to check out our new iPhone and iPad app, it's free. Okay, I'm going to pick up your calls in just one second here, but I just have to say I told you so. I've been saying for quite some time now that the only way that a Republican can win an election is by lying. And especially Mitt Romney, the only way that he can win an election, that he could become president, is by lying. Now, here's the fact. In October of 2009, there were 129.5 million Americans with full-time jobs. 129. Right now there are 133 million Americans with full-time jobs. That's 3.5 million more full-time jobs in the United States than in October 2009. Okay, so 3.5 million jobs have been created, and you add to that the fact that 500,000 jobs have been, you know, 500,000 people, public sector workers, and government employees have been fired, mostly in red states, by red state governors Scott Walker, John Kasich, Rick Snyder, Rick Scott. You know, you fill in the blanks. Really, 4 million jobs have been created. And the workforce has grown by 544,000 people since October of 2009. So knowing those facts, the workforce has grown by over 500,000 and over 3.5 million net new jobs. Over 4 million new jobs have been created. 500,000 were lost to red state governors. So 3.5 million net new jobs have been created. Now those are the facts. Now listen to what Mitt Romney had to say yesterday afternoon.
They said they'd measure progress, for instance, by whether they were able to create jobs. Well, they haven't been able to create jobs. In fact, all of the decline in the rate of unemployment from 10% at its peak to 8.1% now is due not to job creation. It's been due to people falling out of the workforce, dropping out of the workforce.
So there you go. Bald-faced lie. Now, question. On the Sunday talk shows, is there going to be a discussion about why did Mitt Romney lie about that? Anybody want to take a bet? Somehow, I don't think so. Anyway, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Margie in Forsyth, Montana. Hey, Margie, what's up?
I would like to add complexity into the concealed carry debate.
Okay.
I am no fan of ALEC, and you might find it ironic that many of the ALEC members actually have their places posted as no weapons allowed, especially no firearms.
Right.
However, here's my concern. What about people who have jobs that put them in potentially dangerous situations? And I have two examples, both of them from my own life. My ex-husband used to work at an outdoor, four-screen outdoor theater. He had to do bank drops at 2 o'clock in the morning to deposit the money. Mm-hmm. And this was not in a good neighborhood.
Okay.
Second one, what about truck drivers who carry millions of dollars and hijackings are up. What are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
I'm sitting here in a truck armed with a can of wasp spray, and I could come up and have somebody break into my truck with a gun?
Well, I would suggest to you, first of all, I think all of those occupations already qualify you for a concealed carry permit in most states in the United States. And in some states, like Vermont, you don't even need a permit. But secondly, I would submit to you that if you're a truck driver and you're willing to put your life on the line for your load, for what you're carrying, by pulling out a gun, in other words, by provoking a possible gunfight, rather than simply stepping out with your hands in the air, then you're way too dedicated to the customers of whatever that product is you're carrying.
I'm not talking about protecting the load. I'm talking about protecting my life. For example, the person who Jason's Law, which they're trying to pass as part of the highway bill, is named after a truck driver who was murdered while he was sleeping in his cab, and if somebody broke in for the $7 he had on his person.
Yeah.
This is not an unusual instance. We sleep in these things.
Sure.
We have no way to protect ourselves. And that's, in all honesty, the people who are the one associate group of people that are pushing for the federal, that you can go from one state to another,
mm-hmm.
are the truck drivers, because there is no possible way I would ever be able to go to 48 different states and get a concealed weapons.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent
state.
Point. That's an
so
excellent point.
I'm not fond of guns, but I think the debate is more complex.
I agree, but let me add this to that. We've all had experiences with cranky truck drivers, you know, cutting people off in traffic or whatever. You know, there's a lot, 99.9% of truck drivers are great people, but there's a percentage of people who have just been pushed beyond their limits. They're driving when they shouldn't be. They're tired. They're burned out. They're frazzled. They're fried. They're high, whatever. Do we really want to be arming more people on our roads in this era of road rage? Margie? Oh, Margie's gone. Okay. I guess she had her say. I'm not sure that, you know, if somebody's sound asleep in their cab and somebody breaks in and kills them, I don't think having a gun nearby is necessarily going to save their lives. The odds are there wasn't a big standoff and a long confrontation, that it was just whap, you're dead, I got your money kind of thing. And having guns in the cabs of trucks, I'm really conflicted about that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Do you know, in the country of Germany last year, the entire country, police officers fired 85 bullets all year total. People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Ray in Riverside, California. Hey, Ray, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you your opinion about a particular tax idea and to inform the background. Since we don't get any representation for the taxes we pay, most of the representation goes to the billionaires and the lobbyists, basically. And since ordinary working people pay most of the taxes compared to the corporate income, you know, tax income from corporations,
mm-hmm.
and in the spirit of Occupy Wall Street, which basically calls for direct representation, why not introduce a little bit of direct representation into the taxation system? And basically, we know that the majority of U.S. citizens, their sentiments are pretty much in alignment with progressive ideas. So maybe if we, the taxpayers, well, first of all, we can start this as a ballot initiative from from, you know, like grassroots level.
No, I mean, how would it work? What are you proposing?
So every year when we file our taxes with the IRS, we also hand them a list of priorities. So, for example, I would say of the 2,000, 3,000, whatever, 10,000 upwards taxes we paid, I've paid, I want 10% to be spent on education for the poor, 10% on environmental cleanup, et cetera, et cetera. So basically we hand in a list of priorities.
Right.
And we have the technology and the statistical knowledge to basically get a composite real picture of how Americans want their taxes spent.
Right. Aren't you concerned that if we did that, that McDonald, you know, let me back this up a little bit. Right now, if you watch most of the major TV networks, you will see ads that involve oil rigs or ads that involve fighter jets. And it's not because those companies that make those things want you to buy an oil rig or want you to buy, you know, a million cubic feet of natural gas or want you to buy a brand new fighter jet. It's because they're trying to build support for legislation that they may push that may help them, and they're also trying to basically buy good favorable coverage with those media on whom they're advertising. So wouldn't it be, you know, if we did what you just suggested, wouldn't you then start seeing ads from groups that are getting money from the government saying, you know, we really need more R&D for the pharma industry, or we really need more, you know, fill in the blank. And the industries that are not as profitable, I mean, the really profitable industries like the military industrial complex, they would just be pumping out all kinds of ads and get a lot of people to check the little box on their IRS forms. Whereas the industries that are not profitable, like, you know, soup kitchens, they wouldn't be able to buy the ads and a lot of people would forget about them.
Well, I take your point, and that's a very valid point. My counter to that would be, well, those guys already do have the representation they need.
I know.
In the form of the representatives in the Congress.
I know. I agree. They own much of our Congress. I mean, they don't own Bernie Sanders, they don't own Sherrod Brown, and they don't own Jan Schakowsky, but they own a lot of them. Wouldn't a more direct solution be to simply strip money out of politics, to simply be able to pass a law?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Okay,
I mean,
so that's why we need to amend the Constitution and say that to the Supreme Court, sorry, this insane doctrine that you guys have come up with over the last, you know, what, 100 or so years, that corporations are people and that money is speech, that this insane doctrine is not going to stand, that corporations are not people and money is not speech. Money is property. End of discussion. And then you can pass a law. You can put McCain-Feingold on steroids. You could go back to the 1907 Tillman Act that said that any contributions by corporations to political candidates is a felony. I mean, there's so much that you could do that would accomplish that. And then your representatives would actually represent you, because there wouldn't be a corporation or a billionaire, for that matter, because you could limit money in general. You could go back to, like, McCain-Feingold, the maximum donation is $2,000. You could do that. So, you know, interesting idea, Ray, but I think that you're kind of in the middle. The real problem is a little deeper than that, and that's money in politics, and we need to get down to that real problem. But a fascinating idea to on the surface. Not the surface. I don't mean to put your idea down. I think it's a great one. Chris in Duluth, Minnesota. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, just, you know, your last caller brought me to kind of an understanding. If you don't get the money out of the politics, and the low information voters are dependent on only the echo chamber of Fox News and the right wing bloggers, the 1% can basically elect anybody they want.
That's right. And it's not just that, by the way. It is all of mainstream media that sells advertising where the 1% can simply buy ads.
Exactly. And that's the other. It brings me back to my original question, which is I couldn't understand in the first Gulf War and then the second Iraq War why so much of the right wing was up in arms over, France, they're so bad, they're horrible, blah, 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 you know, changed America, French fries to American fries. And I thought, you know, this is bizarre. Why are they doing this? And then I realized, wait a minute, this has been going on. I read some pieces of historical documentation of this has been going on the conservative side for decades.
Arguably since the John Adams administration. John Adams,
yeah,
the
and,
second.
I ran into another little factoid that, you know, a guy from France came over right after or right before or during our revolution, and he was so anti-democracy, he said there's no way a representative republic can ever work. And basically based on the same idea that Churchill had, which is if you ever want a true democracy or an argument against a true democracy, just spend 5 minutes talking to the average voter. And that's the attitude he came over the ocean with, and he said, you know, this democracy, this America, this is never going to work. And then he started talking to farmers out in the fields, and he found out that not only were they well-versed in what's going on in their own little neighborhood, but they knew what was going on in the neighboring states.
And the world.
Neighboring,
and in Europe.
Even the neighboring
his name was Alexis de Tocqueville, and the book he wrote was Democracy in America, and the year was 1836. And it's a brilliant book. It's still worth reading today. It's not that hard to read. The writing is not so archaic that, you know, bad sentence construction. And the other thing with the John Adams, by the way, the French loaned us the money, loaned George Washington the money to fight the Revolutionary War. So we were originally allies with them. But John Adams, the second president of the United States, our first conservative president, our first, hardcore right-wing president, after he passed the Alien Sedition Act in 1798, he really managed to offend a lot of Americans because he shut down 20 newspapers for speaking ill of him. It became a crime in the United States to speak to, you know, Luther Baldwin, the drunk in New Jersey, was in a bar there in Delaware. He was in a bar and made a comment about John Adams that got him, you know, arrested and thrown in jail. Matthew Lyon said something on the floor of the House of Representatives. He was a congressman from Vermont. John Adams had him arrested and thrown into jail. Benjamin Franklin Bach, Ben Franklin's grandson, published an op-ed that said, an editorial that said that President Adams was old, toothless, querulous, and balding. And John Adams had him arrested for that and had his newspaper shut down. So he had people really upset. So he was looking to gain political power. And so what he did was he sent this delegation over to France. One of the people, members of the delegation, by the way, was John Marshall, who, you know, a year later in 1800, he would appoint to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the guy who brought us the Marbury versus Madison decision that gave the Supreme Court all this power. But anyhow, he sent three guys over to France to scope out what was going on in France and to negotiate a particular, I forget what the issue was that they were going to negotiate. And these guys were visited by a basically local criminal who tried to bribe them. When this story came back to John Adams, he turned it into this thing. He called it the XYZ affair and basically suggested that the French government was trying to bribe them and created all this anti-French hysteria. You Google the XYZ affair and get the whole story. And it's just an incredible thing. You're absolutely right. Our xenophobia has deep and long roots. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to WWRL. We've got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, well, the gun issue will come back again. I'm sorry to hear you conflicted on it. I think that woman might have been a plant from the NRA. But on the gay marriage issue, I have a little bit of a different take. I support what the president said, but here's the thing. I think if the president really believes and supports gay marriage the way he says he does, then he should be actively pushing for federal legislation to legalize instead of saying he's going to leave it up to the states to do.
Well, he actually is. Jerry, you don't need federal legislation to legalize gay marriage. You need to do away with existing federal legislation that illegalized gay marriage, and that's the Defense of Marriage Act. And the Republicans in the House of Representatives, the day that he came out in favor of marriage equality, they passed a law in the, it hasn't made it through the Senate, so it's not a law yet, but they passed a law in the House of Representatives, the Republicans, saying that it was illegal for the president to use any federal money to fight DOMA. I mean, that's where it's at. This is, you know, the president is, I think, doing his level best here. and his administration is not defending DOMA in court, and they, you know, they want to see this thing taken apart. But it has to be taken apart by Congress, and it's one of the reasons why if you get a Republican House again and you get a Republican Senate, you can forget about gay marriage. It ain't going
to
happen.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There is a lot at stake in this election. I don't know how to say it other than that. That's absolutely the case. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls in just a minute. But first, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. And the TRNS news brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, what's going on in the world today?
Well, it's been quite a busy Friday. As you heard earlier today, I've got no doubt, J.P. Morgan has posted a $2 billion surprise trading loss.
Yes, and in fact, Jamie Dimon, the CEO, in describing this, actually used the word bet, which makes you wonder, what the hell is a bank doing betting? I thought you went to Las Vegas to bet.
Apparently not. Apparently you just sit at your desk with your computer, and that's how you make a living. You bet.
It's amazing.
That's what you do. And
I understand that this might have come out of a guy in London, out of the J.P. Morgan Chase office in London, who was referred to as the London Whale, who is making bets in commodity markets that exceeded $1 trillion, $1,000 billion.
Exceeded $1 trillion. He was known as the London Whale. Sometimes he was known as Voldemort. His bets were so big that they distorted the market. And in fact, in April, questions surfaced about the chief investment office, which is where he was working, because of these huge bets.
I would bet, no pun intended, that these bets were made on energy, and that, you know, a few weeks ago, one of the Saudi princes who runs the oil business there said oil prices are too high, and they have been steadily declining. And most of the guessing in the industry is that they're steadily declining, in part because supply is way up and demand is down, but most importantly because people are unleveraging their bets on oil, on, you know, they're dumping oil. And so I think they just got caught with their pants down. They got caught flat-footed, or, you know, pick your metaphor.
Well, exactly. Well, it certainly seems that some of these bets were hedging, which is using some bets to offset the risks of other bets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just gets so complicated. And it turns out now that the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, is investigating potential civil violations surrounding the $2 billion loss. Now, what they're looking into, they recently, in recent days, opened a preliminary investigation into J.P. Morgan's accounting practices and their public disclosures about the trades. So they want to know about their past regulatory filings about this chief investment office that plays the trades, as well as recent statements from the firm's top executives, whether they've been telling us the truth or whether they've been telling us porcupines.
Remarkable, remarkable.
Yeah, it really is quite, quite remarkable. Representative Barney Frank, one of the authors of the Wall Street Reform Law, says today that J.P. Morgan had previously estimated that complying with Dodd-Frank would initially cost $400 to $600 million, and says, in other words, J.P. Morgan, entirely without any help from the government, has lost in this one set of transactions five times the amount they claim financial regulation is costing them.
Right. And had they been regulated, they wouldn't have made this kind of bet. They wouldn't have lost this kind of money.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, Jamie Dimon is claiming that the Volcker, who is the head of J.P. Morgan and is a vigorous opponent of the Volcker Rule, right, which is being figured out right now exactly how it's going to work and what it's going to say, says the Volcker Rule would not have covered these bets. Now, we don't know whether that's true or not. We just know that that's what he says. And he said a number of very interesting things on a hastily arranged conference call yesterday, including, just because we're stupid doesn't mean everybody else was, which sounds fairly benign, except when you think about it, if that's his way of saying that this kind of trading was restricted to his company, and is he trying to say everybody else isn't doing it too, when in fact maybe everybody is.
Well, and it's particularly ironic when you get the earlier quotes from Jamie Dimon, in which he said that his opposition to Dodd-Frank and to any kind of reinstatement of Glass-Steagall or any variation thereof is because these are laws that are intended to protect banks from their own stupidity. And he said banks are not stupid, and they don't need to be protected from their own stupidity. And now here he is saying, geez, we lost $2 billion, we're stupid. So.
Exactly, which is quite extraordinary. And then politically it gets interesting because Mitt Romney, the presumptive GOP nominee for president, favors repeal of Dodd-Frank.
Right.
And doesn't want derivatives regulated. He doesn't actually want banks like J.P. Morgan to be regulated at all. And yet just today, even though Romney attacked Obama's regulatory policies by saying that they scared the dickens out of banks, his campaign is saying that, well, he favors common sense regulations and oversight of the derivatives market, but they won't say what that means.
Right. Right. Yeah. He won't say what a lot of things mean. You know, he's got an immigration policy, but he's not going to tell us what it is, for example.
Well, not until he gets the gigs.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Okay. So what else is up?
Well, I mentioned in my email to you this morning about this anti-Islam class that is being taught at a military college in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes.
That the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has condemned for mid-level officers and government civilians. It's actually being taught to military commanders, lieutenant colonels, captains, and colonels.
Wow. And this class talked about the Hiroshima option of basically killing millions and millions of Muslim civilians in order to stop, quote, radical Islam, end quote. And in fact, they said that there's no difference between radical Islam and Islam.
There is no radical Islam. We're at war with all Islam, and the Geneva Conventions do not apply, and that's why Hiroshima or Dresden or anything like that is perfectly okay,
right.
And that should be the plan, that is a perfectly logical conclusion. He has a four-stage solution, this Lieutenant Colonel Dooley, that includes the possibility of reducing Islam to cult status and threatening Saudi Arabia with starvation and destroying Mecca and Medina.
This is going to just, this is really going to hurt. I mean, this story coming out, this is just really insane. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. And the other thing that's mind-boggling, and I think you mentioned this in your email, was that only one guy complained about it.
out
of the hundreds
of
different classes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, well, what about the other 799? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, friends. Let's see here. Hope in Laguna Hills, California, listening to iHeartRadio. Hey, Hope, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Well, I have a suggestion. I believe that all our congressmen should make the average salary of their constituents. I think that should be enacted, and we can really see who they represent.
But their constituents are not required to maintain two residences in two different parts of the country. And so if you did that, what you would find is that the only people who could afford to run for Congress would be rich people.
Well, those are the only people in Congress.
Well, no, not true. This last, you know, with the Tea Party Republicans coming in, now more than half of the members of the House of Representatives are millionaires. But that is a real historical anomaly. Typically, there's a relatively small number of multimillionaires in the House of Representatives, and the Senate has been called the Millionaires Club. Although there are a number of senators, Bernie Sanders is one of them, who are not multimillionaires. I am concerned that there is so much outrage directed at our elected officials, and I get these, particularly these right-wing emails constantly that are, you know, we need to hold these people accountable. We need term limits. We need to cut their pay, you know, bloody until they do deal with the deficit or whatever. And that's not how you do it. That, you know, saying, you know, that if the average person, you know, if a plumber or a teacher or a police officer or a small business person or, you know, a mom wants to or a dad wants to run for Congress, that they're going to have to be able to come up with, you know, the extra $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year it costs to maintain residences in two different cities, one of them being Washington, D.C., arguably one of the most expensive cities in the world, that. You know, I have a real problem with that. I think that our members of Congress should be paid appropriately. I think that if we got the money out, you know, the only reason that members of Congress are Republicans and Democrats, the main reason that they're going to these, that they're selling out, that they're going to special interests, is because there's money in politics. And because we allow that, and the only reason we allow that is because the Supreme Court keeps knocking down efforts to get money out of politics by Congress. The building that I'm in, that I'm broadcasting to you from right now, is just a couple blocks away from the Senate office buildings. And it's not just this building. It's any of the office buildings that are within three or four blocks of the House and Senate buildings here. On various days of the week, you know, if you at various times you walk in and I've been in the elevator with a couple of different senators just by accident. They have offices here where they sit and they dial for dollars for 2, 3, 4 hours a day. They hate it. It makes them crazy. They're spending half their days literally not doing legislation but begging for money. And Democrats and Republicans, and they would love to get the money, but the Supreme Court keeps saying no, money is speech. So that's where we need to attack this, Hope, respectfully. I like the populism of your idea, but we have to consider the practical consequences. Thank you so much for the call, Hope, and thanks a lot for listening. Glenn in Minnetonka, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Well, I said that I found it interesting that J.P. Morgan lost $2 billion, but I find it more interesting to find out who won the $2 billion and whether there wasn't just some, you know, lunchtime agreement that, okay, you'll have the losses this week and we'll have the losses next week and we'll both write them off our taxes.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, my understanding, here's the interesting piece about this is that I'm looking here at the New York Times and looking for the quote. And I can't quickly find it. I read it in the article a little earlier, and they said that these were losses of depositors' money, which means that people who have checking and savings accounts with J.P. Morgan Chase, that's the money that they were gambling with, and that they lost. Right. So
they took it out of the 99% and they gave it to some 1%.
Right.
And so which one was that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very, yeah, because it generally isn't so much a zero sum game, although to some extent in these.
It's pretty damn close when you get to the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a good question. Very good question. Glenn, I echo your cynicism. Thank you for the call. Dan in Gary, Indiana, listening to WCPT. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show today. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment. You had a gal earlier speaking about guns, and she's a family member who's a trucker, and you know, every instance of stuff like this, when we try to argue for the gun ideology in this country, there are always good arguments, but only in this country do we murder ourselves such as we do. Only in this country, no other civilized nation in the world do we do that.
Right.
And every time that somebody has a good argument of why I need a gun, the gun lobbyists and all the manufacturers, all the people who have a moneyed interest in it, are going to get behind that. And I don't know where that ideology takes us, you know, when we use one good argument as to why we should have more guns. And, you know, I feel really hypocritical about this because in our household, we own firearms, but I'll be the first to tell you that if we could just get rid of all of these guns, there'd be a lot less misery in our country, and I think that it goes back to, again, what you talk about so much, which is money, big money, changing laws in our country.
Oh, yeah. And the big money, and the big money right now is in the weapons industry and the guns industry and the NRA that is their trade association and their lobbying group. And this is why I said to that woman who was, who represented herself as a truck driver, and I have no reason to believe she wasn't, that, that, I think personally having a gun in the cab of your truck probably makes you and all of the rest of us less safe, not more safe. And, she's protecting herself with wasp spray. I mean, hey, if that works, pepper spray is legal in most states, I think, but in any case, Dan, thank you for the call. I think you make an excellent point. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's going on?
Hey, Tom. You may or may not know that banks also want to start administrating 401ks.
Right.
That's not the greatest thing either in light of what's happened here. But the reason I called today is I was discussing how to fix Social Security with some in-laws, and you know, I contend we need to remove the cap at 106, take it off. That'll generate a lot of extra income.
That'll generate enough extra income that Social Security will be solvent forever.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, but they're stating that it's being raided still to this day. And what do you know about this? And also, has any of the money that has been borrowed, has it been paid back?
Sure.
I saw that some of it was, but what do you, what's your take on this rating?
It's, this is purely semantic. If you bought, say you had a 401k or a savings account, and you bought $100,000 or $10,000 worth of government treasuries,
okay.
The government just borrowed $10,000 from you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what Social Security has done is they've invested $2.6 trillion in government T-bills. So, you know, the government has borrowed that money. Now, the government borrowed $10,000 from you. In other words, if you bought a $10,000 T-bill, you could argue that you just loaned the government $10,000 and they went out and had a war with it in Iraq.
Right.
Because the government used that money for something. But did they really take your money? Because they're going to pay you back. I mean, you've got a treasury bill, and we've never defaulted on treasuries. So
correct.
Because the Social Security Administration has this $2.6 trillion surplus, which is going to keep them healthy for a hell of a long time, they've invested this in treasuries, which is the appropriate place. Had they invested it in the stock market, it would have gotten wiped out in the crash. And everybody, what the right-wingers are saying is, oh, those treasury bills are just government debt. And, of course, the government spends the money it gets from its debt. Well, yeah, but the government also pays it back. And, in fact, that's factored into the actuarial tables for you know, for future taxes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So there has been no raid on Social Security, bottom line, and the Social Security Administration is doing just fine, thank you very much. That's the bottom line. Steve, thanks for the call.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows. Anything goes.
Friday, Paul in Riffle, Colorado. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for picking up my call. I my issue is with fracking, and I don't really know about the rest of the country, but I know a lot about the area I live in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
A 50-mile stretch on the south side of the Colorado River from Debeck to Canyon Creek, most of the drinking wells now are contaminated and people have to haul their water up. And, you know, any activism or talk against this is really diluted by the high-paying jobs they give the local people here. So it's hard. It's tough being an activist, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have to say is there's only one company that seems to have some integrity, and that's in Canada. They publish the chemicals they use in their fracking, as well as take a real genuine interest in the environment. The rest of them, like Halliburton, I can't say the same.
I think in Canada they're more tightly regulated. They may well be forced to do that.
Yeah, but I believe in results, and they show some good integrity.
Yeah.
Halliburton and the rest of them, you know, I reported to the EPA about dumping the dregs of fracking fluids in a ditch, and I reported to the state, not the county, and the state breached my confidentiality to the county, which quickly spread, and I had people call me, which is really sad, because I'm like an enemy now, and well, I'm used to it anyway, and it doesn't really bother me, but I think it's really important that states with fracking going on really have to be educated on the farsightedness of what this is gonna, what the end result is gonna be, and that's pollution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And destroying our environment here. And I watched it 40 years ago. They said the federal government exploded some devices in Rollison, Colorado. But that wasn't the case at all. That was the big frack. Mm. And most of the wells turned alkaline. And they waited for unemployment to be at its peak for these drilling and fracking companies to come in like swarms and recontaminate the already alkaline wells. And yeah. And as I say, I'm well on top of this, being having lived here for 42, 43 years now. And I just think it's important that the public know, especially Colorado residents, that this is not a good practice.
Have you seen Josh Fox's movie for Gasland?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, okay. I think that you know, if you want to get the word out, probably the very best thing you can do is point people to that movie, because it's, if people like watching movies, it's not that long. It's a great documentary, and it just nails this thing, as you just did, Paul. Paul, I got to move along to other calls, but
sure.
thank you for sharing your experience with us, and thank you for your activism. I genuinely appreciate it. Mike in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Mike, what's up? Mike? No, Mike. Okay. Anthony in San Francisco, California. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First time caller to your show. I've recently discovered it by my boyfriend, who's a very big fan of yours.
Okay.
I'm like a fish out of water out here. I grew up in a predominantly Republican household.
So did I.
I really consider myself a progressive at this point in my life. Just for the simple fact that, you know, progressivism means moving forward and not looking in the past. To me, a liberal just wants to sit there and argue semantics and does not want to come up with concrete solutions.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, there's lots of stuff I want to do. I want to fix health care. I want to do Medicare for all. I think that's a good common sense solution for everybody.
But wait a second. You call yourself a Republican?
Well, yes, still I do.
Okay. Okay. Just trying to establish terms. And yet you think you're a progressive. There have been progressive Republicans, you know, Abraham Lincoln.
Teddy Roosevelt was my favorite president.
Teddy Roosevelt is one of the best presidents that we've had in the history of the United States, arguably. And Teddy Roosevelt could not get elected in the Republican Party of today. There's no way.
Not a good Reagan.
Not even a remote possibility. And so I would, you know, I think it's wonderful that you're progressive and you consider yourself a Republican. I know that the party that my dad was part of and loved, you know, and he was an Eisenhower Republican, as it were, that somebody needs to rescue that party. Somebody needs to bring it back to sanity. And, you know, I would strongly encourage you to go to the Republican Party meetings and run for precinct committee person. This is the Tea Party. In fact, if you there's a couple of different sites. I don't have them right in front of me. We've talked about this on the air at some length, but the Tea Party has videos out on YouTube about how to infiltrate the Republican Party and how to show up at the meetings and run for committee precinct person and basically take over your local Republican Party. And then the committee precinct people are the ones who decide who the primary nominees are going to be. So if you can stack, you know, if you're going to have five people in a primary and make sure that they're all Tea Partiers, or in your case, they're all progressives, you can have an influence on the future of the party. And the Tea Party's done this very successfully with their billions of dollars in the Koch brothers. And you know, I would love to see progressives involved in the Republican Party. Let's bring the Republican Party back to sanity. Let's take it back to where it was with Teddy Roosevelt. You know, good on you. God bless you. I think it's marvelous.
Right.
Thanks,
so,
Tom.
Yeah, I wish you well. I would not try to talk you into being a Democrat, although I'm guessing that you may end up there because the Republican Party is getting kind of crazy. But, boy, do they need your help. Anthony, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening on out in San Francisco. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very brand-new vocabulary word, ugly. And Mitt Romney gets a weird endorsement from a dictator.
You just said you were proud of your money, proud of your money, and you're so vain. You think you can avoid all your taxes. You're so vain. You think that you can buy the White House, White House, White House.
That's amazing. And you, this new, what do you call that? A parody, I suppose. An homage. It's You're So Bane with a B. Amazing. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? This is a topic that needs lots of discussion.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I'm hoping it'll be in the future. We need a whole new labor movement because the labor movement that we have has gone from 35% of the labor force to in the 50s to 7% in private labor now. And it's not just because of Taft-Hartley or Reagan repression. It's because the labor movement has not adjusted to the modern workforce. Namely, it was started as with an industrial workforce, but now 75% of workers are in service industries.
Which is the fastest area of growth for the modern labor movement.
Exactly, 75% and growing. And what that means is that workers in the service industry are, most of them, in daily contact with the community, with the neighborhood. They're in retail, they're in hospitals, and they're in schools. They're in touch with people from the community in a way that industry people were not. You don't talk to people in a factory.
Right.
And that means that you have to organize workers and community together.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be done together, and the best way to do that would be to decentralize into fairly small regions, you know, neighborhoods of, say, maybe 15, 20,000 people, and say that every single person in there, the neighborhood and all the workers in there, have the job of organizing every other worker in the neighborhood and saying, you know, you have to get into a union.
Yeah, I think you need to make the case for the unions, but I don't disagree that it wouldn't be hard to make. What if, but that, you know, I'd never considered that, the modern service, the SEIU workers, the AFSCME workers, the people, and these are the unions that are growing more rapidly than
yeah.
the old industrial unions, that those people are all in contact with the public constantly. What if they all just started wearing a pin or a button that identifies them, that reminds everybody who sees them that they're a union member?
That would be great. Even better is if they could paste a sticker on the outside of the store that says this is a union shop and
mm-hmm.
do some gorilla stickering and say this is not. And the neighborhood has to do it too. And, you know, there is actually a precedent for this in American labor movement. It was the Knights of Labor.
Sure.
Because they
But that was that was in the late 19th century. I mean,
Yeah. They were organized regionally. And in addition, their perfect idea for winning a strike was not only to get higher wages, but to create a co-op.
Right.
And so the thing that the workers in the neighborhood and the neighborhood people, the residents of the neighborhood would have in common is that they could be both working on co-ops.
Right. This is an area where you have, you know, the Steelworkers Union now has, originally most unions were against co-ops, modern unions.
Yeah.
And the Steelworkers Union now, Leo Gerard's union, has, I believe that they have two steel factories that are either in the process or already have converted
mm-hmm.
from owner-operated to employee-owned and operated, you know, to co-ops. And SEIU is doing something in California. I forget if it's a hospital or a school, but they're you know, doing a co-op program with one of those. So I think this is the future for the labor movement, and I think it could be a really, really great future.
But the decentralization, you know, the problem is you have these central labor councils,
right,
and they're countywide. Well, the county I live in, Alameda County, that's 3 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a community. You have to break it down into small units,
right,
and deputize the neighborhood leadership.
Get to local folks. Well, and this is why I said, you know, if everybody wears a pin, then everybody would know, oh, this is a union shop, and oh, this isn't, where's your pin? But you know, maybe this is not the era of such conformist kind of behavior. I don't know. Lawrence, excellent idea. Thank you for cracking it open for us. I appreciate the call. Charles in Webster, Iowa. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Oh, I just thought I'd give you some geeky science for Friday here.
Okay.
And as a recovering school teacher here, I have to do this sometimes to keep myself going.
All right.
Research was done by a British university and reported, I think, in the Guardian or one of those British newspapers that there's a possibility that the dinosaurs may have farted themselves to death.
Yes, I read that day before yesterday, that it was 540 million, if I'm remembering right, tons of methane were produced every year by the sauropods, just by that one branch of dinosaurs, the vegetable-eating ones.
Like
the brontosaurus is a member of the sauropods.
Yes, and the sauropods was a lot of them, and they had these things where they drop off about a ton of poop a day per dinosaur, and of course they ate over 330,000 calories per day. Now, that's
wow.
A lot of leafy vegetables, and you can pretty much guarantee that that's going to create a lot of gas.
Right, and the methane from the dinosaur farts is methane's about 18 times more effective as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, you know, what it does is it shows that it's possible to alter the atmosphere of the planet in very big ways with what seems like, you know, small things, although the dinosaurs are pretty big.
Oh, but yes.
But they weren't as big as, you know, a modern refinery, for example, or a ship carrying products across the ocean. So excellent point, Charles. Thanks for calling and sharing it with you. I appreciate it. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I am so concerned about Fukushima. Ron Wyden went over there, Senator Wyden, and he came back like white as a ghost, right?
Yep.
Because the spent fuel rods are just kind of hanging on the
on
edges.
Reactor 4, yes. It's already listing.
Yes.
And they've got 85 times the radioactive cesium that Chernobyl emitted.
Exactly.
Sitting
so
on
I
the
got
roof.
Home. I listened to this, and I just really got freaked out. I'm like, what can we do? And I called around, and I talked to Bob Alvarez from the Institute for Policy Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that guy is really on it. He used to work for the Department of Energy,
mm-hmm.
and he helped, like, stabilize some nuclear situations in North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So he has got this total plan. He's like, you know, the State Department has to be involved, and the Department of Energy, and the military, and he's like got this whole list and everything. And he's talking to Ron Wyden. But I think we need to put some pressure on Obama, because it's going to definitely, Obama's going to have to agree to send over machinery, men, and funds, because TEPCO is broke.
Well, TEPCO's maybe broke, but the Japanese government is not. And I don't think that we need to be bailing them out or bailing out the nuclear plant. I mean, the problem that we have is that we have 40 reactors that are identical in design and construction to Unit 4 at Fukushima, the one that's listing, that it had an explosion and that is now listing, where the spent fuel rods are in the roof. They're in a swimming pool on the roof on top of the containment vessel, and that's insane. I mean, I think that we need to be doing what Japan completed last week when the people came out and celebrated in the streets when they shut down the last nuclear reactor. We need to do what Germany did 10 years ago, where they said, okay, we're not going to build any more nuclear power plants. We're going to start decommissioning them, and instead we're going to generate 10 gigawatts. Each nuclear power plant is typically 1 gigawatt, a billion watts. We're going to create 10 gigawatts, 10 nuclear reactors worth of solar power by subsidizing solar panels for people's roofs and their houses all across the country. And they did it. In fact, Germany has now had to scale back that program because they have so much surplus electricity that until they modernize their electric grid, they can't deal with it all. And you know, these are the things we need to be doing.
Tom, I hate to interrupt here, but we are in real danger. Fukushima is a real international emergency right now.
I agree.
And we do have to push Obama to send over machinery, men, funds, and have it, an international effort. Bob Alvarez was talking about some experts in Norway and France. We have experts here. They do need our help. So there is a petition at NIRS, NIRS.org, NIRS.org, where people can sign on encouraging Obama to get involved. And then there is another petition from the Japanese activists, anti-nuclear activists, calling for Ban Ki-moon to get involved in, as well. Apparently, they do need our help for emergency relief to stabilize Fukushima.
Japan is an incredibly wealthy country.
I know, but apparently that there's something going on there between TEPCO and the government, and they are not, they don't have the expertise. It is in really, really bad shape. Even the experts here say we are, it's going to be very, very tricky getting these fuel, spent fuel.
There's actually,
out of those pools.
Yeah, this is the problem. There's no way to do it right now. I mean, there is no technology that can get those spent fuel rods out of because they've got reactor one or two. One of those two reactors right now is blowing off radiation that is so bright, that is so hot, that it'll kill anybody who gets near it. And so they can't bring in, I mean, they tried armoring helicopters with lead when they were dropping water, and they discovered that those guys were getting so much radiation, and now they don't have helicopter pilots. You've got the elderly people in Japan who are volunteering for basically suicide missions to go into Fukushima, and they've become the national heroes because they're willing to show up. But it's like, you know, these stories are not filtering through the American media. We've had Beyond Nuclear on this program a number of times, and I'm just astounded by how little coverage this is getting. But Laura, you're right, and thank you for the call, and thanks for raising the flag on this. It is a big deal. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and I still haven't played for you The Dictator endorsing Mitt Romney. This is so cool. We'll do that when we come back.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Paul Edney, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our syndicators, Dial Global for commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations around the world, to Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others around the country, to Don Rojas and all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you. Thank you for supporting our program. It is genuinely much appreciated. This is Sacha Baron Cohen has got a movie coming out. I think it's called The Dictator. And he is doing the circuit right now, pumping up the energy for it. And he held a press conference last week, and one of the, well, here's clip number four.
But if it was the money that I was giving, I support and I give my full support to Mitchell Romney. He has the makings of a great dictator. He is incredibly wealthy, but pays no taxes. And it's not much of a leap to go from firing people to firing squads.
And tying dogs to the roof of cars to tying dissidents to the roofs of cars. Sacha Baron Cohen, the dictator, has come out and endorsed Mitt Romney. He also had this to say about the Republican Party. This is a good one.
I want to ask, which U.S. presidential candidate would you endorse?
Or the U.S.? I would say Santorum, despite his liberal views. But since he is out of the running, I don't know. In terms of policies, I would have to say the Republicans, if they could only become a little less extreme.
Yeah, if only they could become a little less extreme. JP in Macomb County, Michigan. Hey, JP, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'd like to I might offer a Tea Party view to add some balance. I'm from Detroit, and I've seen firsthand what unions and what trying to set prices by political means instead of economic reality does to a society, and I think you understand.
How are unions not economic reality?
Well, if they can get their money through a voluntary and free negotiation with the management based on economic reality, I don't have a problem with how much.
How can you how can an individual worker voluntarily and freely negotiate with a multi-billion dollar corporation?
Well, he's got to prove his worth on the marketplace, and he's got to make what he can't get paid more than he delivers to the company.
So if you're the slave, you should just accept your station in life.
Well, you're not a slave because working is voluntary in this country. So what you can do is go in and get some politician to side with your view, and then by extortion or political means, force a company to pay more than you're worth, thereby chasing an industry out of Detroit, Michigan, like the auto industry.
So you don't believe that workers should have the right to bring democracy into the workplace, that you believe that workplaces should be purely autocratic little kingdoms where you as the employee have to do whatever your employer tells you, and if you don't like it, you can just quit and go find another job. Do I have that right?
If you bring politics into economic
matters, just answer my question. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't support politics in an economic framework.
So you believe that the employer should be able to play politics and buy politicians and spend all the money they want, but the workers, if they try to do that, they can be fired?
Absolutely not. I didn't agree with Barack Obama and George Bush's decision to bail out Wall Street. I was opposed to that as a Tea Party member as well.
But if you agree with the notion that employees have no say in the workplace, then what has to go along with that is that the employers have all the say. And if the employers have all the say, they can choose to do whatever they damn well please. They can buy politicians. They can buy ads. They can buy public influence and public opinion. To hell with the workers.
No, the if you took politics out of the economy where politicians couldn't pick winners or losers in the economy, then nobody would go to Washington to buy them. The reason why anybody's going to Washington is because the government has the power to pick winners and losers through preferential tax and regulatory policies.
Well, there is some truth to that. And what you're telling me is that you think that the corporations should have the power to do that. I mean, that's certainly, the Koch brothers, the big funders of the Tea Party, Dick Armey, as we speak, Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is holding a meeting where they've got Republican legislators, mostly Tea Partiers from all over the country, sitting side by side with oil and coal industry executives to come up with new legislation that will be introduced into the states. You can read about this over at thinkprogress.org. They busted the whole thing wide open. And so what you're saying is that you think that the employees should have no say in that, but the employers should be able to just do whatever they damn well please, because, after all, that's how American capitalism works in a Tea Party world, right?
Absolutely not. What happens when when you take the government out of the equation?
So how are you going to stop those employers from trying to bribe the government?
Because the only way they can make money is satisfying consumer preferences.
Wait a minute. How are you going to stop them from buying a politician? Are you going to pass a law against it?
Why would they want to buy a politician if a politician has no control over the economy?
Well, because we the people have to have a referee. You can't have a football game without referees. There have to be referees.
I got a referee every time I walk in a store. If I don't like something from a corporation because they're overcharged or their employees are underpaid and they got lower quality, I just don't buy it.
Well, you must not buy a whole lot.
No, there's a lot of companies taking care of me, and I've got choices. But when you have government running the show, that's the biggest monopoly of all. They control everything, and they've got all the guns. They tell us what and when, and that's not an acceptable solution.
That's decentralized power. Fascinating. JP, you got it all out there, and I didn't, I'm not going to take you part on it. Thank you for the call. You got to understand, this is how a lot of people are thinking, and they don't get it, that what the logical endpoint of what JP was just saying is, you and I surrender all of our power as citizens to the billionaires, to the Mitt Romneys of the world, and to the big corporations. That's JP's world. It's kind of sad. And tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.